Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman and this is the Sunday Roundup. Once again, the TV studios played host to those aspiring to replace Jeremy Corbyn as leader of the Labour Party. Sophie Ridge spoke to the Shadow Business Secretary Rebecca Long-Bailey and asked her about why she felt Labour had lost in December.
I think there was a variety of reasons. It was one of the worst election defeats we've ever faced. And people say that it was Brexit election, and Brexit was a huge factor. It certainly came up on the doorstep in my constituency. However, there were a number of other issues. Our manifesto was not being sold on the doorstep. The messages that should have gone through about economic competence, the fact that we were going to roll out a green industrial revolution and kickstart the economy in regions and nations across the UK simply wasn't resonating with people. And certainly the ground campaign itself, we had reports of members being sent to seats that we had no hope of winning when we should have been in constituencies trying to protect MPs who were at risk of losing their seats.
At the same time, though, it can't just be selling the policies that's the issue. Is it the policies themselves that are the problem?
Not at all. And certainly, I mean, there were a number of areas where we hadn't done enough work in convincing voters of our credibility on those areas. There were certainly other policies that were part of a longer-term programme. They were the right answers to the right questions, but perhaps for a manifesto, they should have been left for a longer-term goal.
You say that Labour had the right answers to the right questions. Does that mean you think Labour won the argument?
Not at all. We didn't win the argument. If we'd won the argument, we'd have won the general election, unfortunately, and we didn't. We just weren't trusted. And that goes for the message that we put out in our campaign, which didn't bring together all of the positive aspects of our manifesto. We weren't trusted on Brexit. We weren't trusted to deal with anti-Semitism within our own party. Key issues, and you have to earn trust. It doesn't just happen overnight.
Long-Bailey also told Ridge about her plans to make big changes to the Houses of Parliament.
You wrote this week that Labour must go to war with the political establishment, pledging a constitutional revolution that sweeps away the House of Lords. Does that mean you want to abolish the House of Lords?
That's right, I do want to abolish the House of Lords, and we'll be rolling out, as my campaign progresses, how we intend to really shake up that constitutional package. Because MPs like myself, we're fed up of the Westminster bubble and we're fed up of our communities feeling like decisions about their lives are made in Westminster consistently. We've got to shift power and wealth into our communities, and that needs to be done in a democratic and structured way.
So how would you find a system where there was a check on the activities of the House of Commons? Because that is historically the role of the House of Lords, right?
There will need to be checks and balances in place, but to have a set of completely unelected people doing that, I don't think is right. And I think many people within our communities would not think that was right. We need to have people who are able, experts, people who feel that they're democratically accountable to the communities that they represent, not people who were appointed by parties.
Another leadership hopeful, Clive Lewis, told Ridge why he wanted to see a referendum on the future of the royal family.
On Friday, you said about the royal family, we can just put the quote in the wall, why not have a referendum in this country on the future of the royal family? We're a democracy, I'd rather see us as citizens than subjects. So would you like to see a referendum on the future of the royal family?
So what you'll see in the manifesto that we've launched today, one of the key things we're talking in here is about a constitutional convention. And, you know, we live in the 21st century now. And I think that if you're going to allow people a real say over the kind of country they want to live in, it may well be at one of those constitutional conventions that people actually say, we'd like to talk about the entirety of the state. And that could well include the royal family, what size it is, what its function is. I think we've seen this week, there's a great love for the royal family in this country, but there's also, I think, some concerns about how it will go forward into the future. And I think giving people real power, real agency, a real say over their lives, if people wanted to have that referendum, then that would be up to them.
But I think, how would you vote if there was a referendum? Would you vote for it to be scrapped?
I'd listen to the debate, and I'd like to hear.
What's your personal view?
I'm a Republican.
So
I believe I'm a citizen. Well, I think maybe moderated, maybe changed, but I actually want to be a citizen in this country, not a subject. I want to have real say, real power. I want my community to have real say, real power over its lives.
Ridge queried Lewis about a tweet he posted last year where he appeared to describe Brexit as a racist endeavour. Lewis defended his remarks.
Now, in 2019, you tweeted this in response to an attack on the activist and columnist Owen Jones. You said, "Welcome to Brexit Britain. To be frank, I've had enough of this reactionary, right-wing and racist endeavour. We need to end it now."
Yeah.
Do you think Brexit is a racist endeavour?
I think part of the Brexit campaign and part of the undertone of Brexit from some politicians, Nigel Farage and others, had racism at its core, at its heart. They used it as a mechanism to divide our communities, to divide our country. And one of the things about
Do you think Brexit is a racist endeavour, which is what you say here?
But if you think about moving away, there's a potential for Brexit, and I think we've seen it. You know, how many people of colour, how many black people, on the day after the referendum, woke up with a sense of dread because of what had happened? Ultimately, our country had chosen to listen to Boris Johnson, someone who has a track record of racist commentary, of giving credence to racism, to Nigel Farage, someone who stood in front of a poster which was overtly racist. This was a government that had the Windrush scandal, that had go-home vans. So I think for anyone to say that there was not an element of racism in the Brexit project as an endeavour, you're basically wrong. And I think you can see that. And I think ask the millions of black people in this country who understood what much of the dog whistle politics and tone was on this issue, then I think you understand that was completely. Now, that doesn't mean that every single person that voted for Brexit is a racist. Some of my family voted for Brexit. But I think that there were drivers within that campaign which certainly were very unsavoury and which I would call racist.
Moving from one Lewis to another, Andrew Marr interviewed the security minister, Brandon Lewis. He asked him about the news that the UK's ambassador to Iran had been arrested and questioned in connection with protests after Iranian forces shot down a Ukrainian passenger aircraft by mistake.
We all woke up this morning to the news about our ambassador in Tehran, went to a vigil for the victims of the air disaster, turned into a demonstration, went to get his hair cut and was lifted by the Iranians and apprehended against, I think, every single rule of international diplomacy. First of all, have you spoken to him? Do you know how he is?
I haven't personally spoken to the ambassador, but as a government, we have done. He's actually tweeted, I think, in the last hour or so about what happened. It's completely unacceptable. I think you're right. Breach of certainly the Vienna Convention, a whole range of things. Iran is at a crossroads. They've got a decision to make. And the point we're making, the Foreign Secretary has said just this morning, is we want to see things de-escalate. We want to see Iran come back into that international fold and play their part. But they are at a crossroads, and they've got to make that decision. We want to see them come back in and de-escalate.
A very sensitive moment. Do we respond to what's happened to our ambassador beyond protesting verbally?
Well, look, I'm not going to go into details about the conversations we're having around some of the details, particularly because some of these link in with security at the moment. I hope you'll appreciate that. But what they've done is completely unacceptable. It is a breach, and we want to see them make the right decision at the crossroads they're currently at.
Ireland's Deputy Prime Minister Simon Coveney told Marr that the UK government's confidence that it would not have to extend the Brexit transition period past the end of 2020 may be misplaced.
Do you now concede or accept that Boris Johnson is not going to extend these negotiations beyond the end of this year, come what may?
Well, that's a matter for Boris Johnson. I mean, I certainly accept that the United Kingdom is now leaving the European Union at the end of this month, and that's something that... That now has a withdrawal agreement to put structure around that decision. We move into the next phase of Brexit, which is really now to try to put in place a permanent future relationship that's good for Britain, but is also good for countries like Ireland and the rest of the European Union. And our focus, from an Irish perspective, is to try to achieve the closest possible relationship between Britain and the EU, from a trade perspective, from a political perspective, from a security perspective, from a data perspective, from an aviation perspective. You know, the list goes on and on and on. Sure. And so when people talk about the future relationship in the UK in particular, they seem to only talk about a future trade agreement. Actually, there's much more to this than that.
That's really
interesting. There's fishing, there's aviation, there's data, and there's so many other things. And, you know, I know that that Prime Minister Johnson has set a very ambitious timetable to get this done. He's even put it into British law. But just because a British Parliament decides that British law says something doesn't mean that that law applies to the other 27 countries of the European Union. And so the European Union will approach this on the basis of getting the best deal possible, a fair and balanced deal, to ensure that the UK and the EU can interact as friends in the future. But the EU will not be rushed on this just because Britain passes law.
And finally, the Shadow Foreign Secretary, Emily Thornberry, gave her verdict on who should foot the bill for Prince Harry and Meghan Markle's security as they prepare to spend more time overseas.
Harry and Meghan, in a real debate about what they're going to do, whether they're going to, as it were, leave the royal family and move to Canada and move into the private sector. If that happens, do you think there's any circumstances in which the British taxpayer would pay for that, for their security?
No, I think the British taxpayer should pay for the security of Harry and Meghan and their family, as they do with former ministers. Listen, you know, Harry spent 20 years on the front line in Afghanistan through many tours of duty. He has done great service just on the basis of that. And I just hate to think what he must be thinking now, having used his instinct to try and defend our country. Now he has his much-loved wife and his baby under the type of media scrutiny that they're suffering. Just look at what's in the papers today. 17, 18 pages. He, as a man, must be really wanting to defend them, and I understand that completely. And I also understand that a young couple really ought to be allowed to make their own decisions about what their future should be. And if they decide they want to go to Canada, of course, they must always be protected.
That's all for this week. I'm Isabel Hardman, and this podcast was produced by Matthew Taylor. Don't forget to subscribe to the Coffee House Shots podcast on the iTunes store, and we also have a special offer. You can subscribe to The Spectator for 12 weeks in print and online for just £12, and you'll receive a free £20 gift card to spend at Amazon. Just go to spectator.co.uk/voucher. And if you enjoyed this podcast, do subscribe to our daily Evening Blend email. It's a free roundup of all the political news each day, along with analysis and a diary on what to expect next. Just go to spectator.co.uk/eveningblend. Thanks for listening, and do join us again next week.